effects of toxic gases on the human body. To understand more exactly how carbon monoxide leaks killed miners, he methodically poisoned himself, carefully taking and measuring his own blood samples the while. He quit only when he was on the verge of losing all muscle control and his blood saturation level had reached 56%, a level, as Trevor Norton notes in his entertaining history of diving Stars Beneath the Sea, only fractionally removed from nearly certain lethality. Haldane's son Jack, known to posterity as JBS, was a remarkable prodigy who took an interest in his father's work almost from infancy. At the age of 3, he was overheard demanding peevishly of his father, "But is it oxyhemoglobin or carboxyhemoglobin?" Throughout his youth, the young Haldane helped his father with experiments. By the time he was a teenager, the two often tested gases and gas masks together, taking turns to see how long it took them to pass out. Although JBS Haldane never took a degree in science, he studied classics at Oxford, he became a brilliant scientist in his own right, mostly in Cambridge. The biologist Peter Medawar, who spent his life around mental Olympians, called him "the cleverest man I ever knew." Huxley likewise parodied the younger Haldane in his novel Antic Hay, but also used his ideas on genetic manipulation of humans as the basis for the plot of Brave New World. Among many other achievements, Haldane played a central role in marrying Darwinian principles of evolution to the genetic work of Gregor Mendel to produce what is known to geneticists as the modern synthesis. Perhaps uniquely among human beings, the younger Haldane found World War I a very enjoyable experience, and freely admitted that he enjoyed the opportunity of killing people. He was himself wounded twice. After the war, he became a successful popularizer of science and wrote 23 books, as well as over 400 scientific papers. His books are still thoroughly readable and instructive, though not always easy to find. He also became an enthusiastic Marxist. It has been suggested, not altogether cynically, that this was out of a purely contrarian instinct, and that if he had been born in the Soviet Union, he would have been a passionate monarchist. At all events, most of his articles first appeared in the communist Daily Worker. Whereas his father's principal interests concerned miners and poisoning, the younger Haldane became obsessed with saving submariners and divers from the unpleasant consequences of their work. With Admiralty funding, he acquired a decompression chamber that he called the pressure pot. This was a metal cylinder into which 3 people at a time could be sealed and subjected to tests of various types, all painful and nearly all dangerous. Volunteers might be required to sit in ice water while breathing aberrant atmosphere, or subjected to rapid changes of pressurization. In one experiment, Haldane simulated a dangerously hasty ascent to see what would happen. What happened was that the dental fillings in his teeth exploded. "Almost every experiment," Norton writes, "ended with someone having a seizure, bleeding, or vomiting." The chamber was virtually soundproof, so the only way for occupants to signal unhappiness or distress was to tap insistently on the chamber wall, or to hold up notes to a small window. On another occasion, while poisoning himself with elevated levels of oxygen, Haldane had a fit so severe that he crushed several vertebrae. Collapsed lungs were a routine hazard. Perforated eardrums were quite common, but as Haldane reassuringly noted in one of his essays, "the drum generally heals up, and if a hole remains in it, although one is somewhat deaf, one can blow tobacco smoke out of the ear in question, which is a social accomplishment." What was extraordinary about this was not that Haldane was willing to subject himself to such risk and discomfort in the pursuit of science, but that he had no trouble talking colleagues and loved ones into climbing into the chamber too. Sent on a simulated descent, his wife once had a fit that lasted 13 minutes. When at last she stopped bouncing across the floor, she was helped to her feet and sent home to cook dinner. Haldane happily employed whoever happened to be around, including on one memorable occasion a former Prime Minister of Spain, Juan Negrin. Dr. Negrin complained afterward of minor tingling and a curious velvety sensation on the lips, but otherwise seemed to have escaped unharmed. He may have considered himself very lucky. A similar experiment with oxygen deprivation left Haldane without feeling in his buttocks and lower spine for 6 years. Among Haldane's many specific preoccupations was nitrogen intoxication. For reasons that are still poorly understood, beneath depths of about 100 feet, nitrogen becomes a powerful intoxicant. Under its influence, divers have been known to offer their air hoses to passing fish, or decide to try to have a smoke break. It also produced wild mood swings. In one test, Haldane noted, the subject alternated between depression and elation, at one moment begging to be decompressed because he felt bloody awful, and the next minute laughing and attempting to interfere with his colleague's dexterity test. In order to measure the rate of deterioration in the subject, a scientist had to go into the chamber with the volunteer to conduct simple mathematical tests. But after a few minutes, as Haldane later recalled, the tester was usually as intoxicated as the testee and often forgot to press the spindle of his stopwatch, or to take proper notes. The cause of the inebriation is even now a mystery. It is thought that it may be the same thing that causes alcohol intoxication, but as no one knows for certain what causes that, we're none the wiser. At all events, without the greatest care, it is easy to get in trouble once you leave the surface world. Which brings us back, well, nearly, to our earlier observation that Earth is not the easiest place to be an organism, even if it is the only place. Of the small portion of the planet's surface that is dry enough to stand on, a surprisingly large amount is too hot, or cold, or dry, or steep, or lofty to be of much use to us. Partly, it must be conceded, this is our fault. In terms of adaptability, humans are pretty amazingly useless. Like most animals, we don't much like really hot places, but because we sweat so freely and easily stroke, we are especially vulnerable. In the worst circumstances, on foot, without water in a hot desert, most people will grow delirious and keel over, possibly never to rise again, in no more than 6 or 7 hours. We are no less helpless in the face of cold. Like all mammals, humans are good at generating heat, but because we are so nearly hairless, not good at keeping it. Even in quite mild weather, half the calories you burn go to keep your body warm. Of course, we can counter these frailties to a large extent by employing clothing and shelter, but even so, the portions of Earth on which we are prepared or able to live are modest indeed, just 12% of the total land area, and only 4% of the whole surface if you include the seas. Yet when you consider conditions elsewhere in the known universe, the wonder is not that we use so little of our planet, but that we have managed to find a planet that we can use even a bit of. You have only to look at our own solar system, or come to that, Earth, at certain periods in its own history, to appreciate that most places are much harsher and much less amenable to life than our mild, blue, watery globe. So far, space scientists have discovered about 70 planets outside the solar system, out of the 10 billion trillion or so that are thought to be out there, so humans can hardly claim to speak with authority on the matter, but it appears that if you wish to have a planet suitable for life, you have to be just awfully lucky, and the more advanced the life, the luckier you have to be. Various observers have identified about 24 particularly helpful breaks we have had on Earth. But this is a flying survey, so we'll distill them down to the principal 4. They are: excellent location. We are, to an almost uncanny degree, the right distance from the right sort of star, one that is big enough to radiate lots of energy, but not so big as to burn itself out swiftly. It is a curiosity of physics that the larger a star, the more rapidly it burns. Had our sun been 10 times as massive, it would have exhausted itself after 10 million years instead of 10 billion, and we wouldn't be here now. We are also fortunate to orbit where we do. Too much nearer, and everything on Earth would have boiled away. Too much farther away, and everything would have frozen. In 1978, an astrophysicist named Michael Hart made some calculations and concluded that Earth would have been uninhabitable had it been just 1% farther from, or 5% closer to, the sun. That's not much. And in fact, it wasn't enough. The figures have since been refined and made a little more generous. 5% nearer and 15% farther are thought to be more accurate assessments for our zone of habitability, but that is still a narrow belt. The discovery of extremophiles in the boiling mud pots of Yellowstone and similar organisms found elsewhere made scientists realize that actually life of a type could range much farther than that, even perhaps beneath the icy skin of Pluto. What we're talking about here are the conditions that would produce reasonably complex surface creatures. To appreciate just how narrow, you have only to look at Venus. Venus is only 25 million miles closer to the Sun than we are. The Sun's warmth reaches it just 2 minutes before it touches us. In size and composition, Venus is very like Earth, but the small difference in orbital distance made all the difference to how it turned out. It appears that during the early years of the solar system, Venus was only slightly warmer than Earth, and probably had oceans. But those few degrees of extra warmth meant that Venus could not hold on to its surface water, with disastrous consequences for its climate. As its water evaporated, the hydrogen atoms escaped into space, and the oxygen atoms combined with carbon to form a dense atmosphere of the greenhouse gas CO2. Venus became stifling. Although people of my age will recall a time when astronomers hoped that Venus might harbour life beneath its padded clouds, possibly even a kind of tropical verdure, we now know that it is much too fierce an environment for any kind of life that we can reasonably conceive of. Its surface temperature is a roasting 470 degrees centigrade, roughly 900 degrees Fahrenheit, which is hot enough to melt lead. And the atmospheric pressure at the surface is 90 times that of Earth, or more than any human body could withstand. We lack the technology to make suits or even spaceships that would allow us to visit. Our knowledge of Venus's surface is based on distant radar imagery and some startled squawks from an unmanned Soviet probe that was dropped hopefully into the clouds in 1972 and functioned for barely an hour before permanently shutting down. So that's what happens when you move 2 light minutes closer to the Sun. Travel farther out, and the problem becomes not heat, but cold, as Mars frigidly attests. It, too, was once a much more congenial place, but couldn't retain a usable atmosphere and turned into a frozen waste. But just being the right distance from the Sun cannot be the whole story, for otherwise the Moon would be forested and fair, which patently it is not. For that, you need to have the right kind of planet. I don't imagine even many geophysicists, when asked to count their blessings, would include living on a planet with a molten interior, but it's a pretty near certainty that without all that magma swirling around beneath us, we wouldn't be here now. Apart from much else, our lively interior created the outgassing that helped to build an atmosphere, and provided us with a magnetic field that shields us from cosmic radiation. It also gave us plate tectonics, which continually renews and rumples the Earth. If Earth were perfectly smooth, it would be covered everywhere with water to a depth of 4 kilometers. There might be life in that lonesome ocean, but there certainly wouldn't be baseball. In addition to having a beneficial interior, we also have the right elements in the correct proportions. In the most literal way, we are made of the right stuff. This is so crucial to our well-being that we are going to discuss it more fully in a minute, but first we need to consider the two remaining factors, beginning with another one that is often overlooked. We're a twin planet. Not many of us normally think of the Moon as a companion planet, but that is in effect what it is. Most moons are tiny in relation to their master planet. The Martian satellites of Phobos and Deimos, for instance, are only about 10 kilometers in diameter. Our Moon, however, is more than a quarter the diameter of the Earth, which makes ours the only planet in the solar system with a sizable Moon in comparison to itself. Except Pluto, which doesn't really count, because Pluto is itself so small. And what a difference that makes to us. Without the Moon's steadying influence, the Earth would wobble like a dying top, with goodness knows what consequences for climate and weather. The Moon's steady gravitational influence keeps the Earth spinning at the right speed and angle to provide the sort of stability necessary for the long and successful development of life. This won't go on forever. The moon is slipping from our grasp at a rate of about 1.5 inches a year. In another 2 billion years, it will have receded so far that it won't keep us steady, and we will have to come up with some other solution. But in the meantime, you should think of it as much more than just a pleasant feature in the night sky. For a long time, astronomers assumed that the moon and Earth either formed together, or that the Earth captured the moon as it drifted by. We now believe, as you will recall from an earlier chapter, that about 4.5 billion years ago, a Mars-sized object slammed into Earth, blowing out enough material to create the moon from the debris. This was obviously a very good thing for us, but especially so as it happened such a long time ago. If it had happened in 1896, or last Wednesday, clearly we wouldn't be nearly so pleased about it. Which brings us to our fourth and in many ways most crucial consideration. Timing. The universe is an amazingly fickle and eventful place, and our existence within it is a wonder. If a long and unimaginably complex sequence of events, stretching back 4.6 billion years or so, hadn't played out in a particular manner at particular times, if, to take just one obvious instance, the dinosaurs hadn't been wiped out by a meteor when they were, you might well be 6 inches long, with whiskers and a tail, and reading this in a burrow. We don't really know for sure, because we have nothing else to compare our own existence to, but it seems evident that if you wish to end up as a moderately advanced thinking society, you need to be at the right end of a very long chain of outcomes involving reasonable periods of stability interspersed with just the right amount of stress and challenge. Ice ages appear to be especially helpful in this regard, and marked by a total absence of real cataclysm. As we shall see in the pages that remain to us, we are very lucky to find ourselves in that position. And on that note, let us now turn briefly to the elements that made us. There are 92 naturally occurring elements on Earth, plus a further 20 or so that have been created in labs, but some of these we can immediately put to one side, as in fact chemists themselves tend to do. Not a few of our earthly chemicals are surprisingly little known. Astatine, for instance, is practically unstudied. It has a name and a place on the periodic table, next door to Marie Curie's polonium, but almost nothing else. The problem isn't scientific indifference, but rarity. There just isn't much astatine out there. The most elusive element of all, however, appears to be francium, which is so rare that it is thought that our entire planet may contain, at any given moment, fewer than 20 francium atoms. Altogether, only about 30 of the naturally occurring elements are widespread on Earth, and barely half a dozen are of central importance to life. As you might expect, oxygen is our most abundant element, accounting for just under 50% of the Earth's crust. But after that, the relative abundances are often surprising. Who would guess, for instance, that silicon is the second most common element on Earth, or that titanium is 10th. Abundance has little to do with their familiarity or utility to us. Many of the more obscure elements are actually more common than the better-known ones. There is more cerium on Earth than copper, more neodymium and lanthanum than cobalt or nitrogen. Tin barely makes it into the top 50, eclipsed by such relative obscurities as praseodymium, samarium, gadolinium, and dysprosium. Abundance also has little to do with ease of detection. Aluminum is the fourth most common element on Earth, accounting for nearly a tenth of everything that's underneath your feet, but its existence wasn't even suspected until it was discovered in the 19th century by Humphrey Davy. And for a long time after that it was treated as rare and precious. Congress nearly put a shiny lining of aluminum foil atop the Washington Monument to show what a classy and prosperous nation we had become, and the French imperial family in the same period discarded the state silver dinner service and replaced it with an aluminum one. The fashion was cutting edge, even if the knives weren't. Nor does abundance necessarily relate to importance. Carbon is only the 15th most common element, accounting for a very modest 0.048% of Earth's crust, but we would be lost without it. What sets the carbon atom apart is that it is shamelessly promiscuous. It is the party animal of the atomic world, latching onto many other atoms, including itself, and holding tight, forming molecular conga lines of hearty robustness, the very trick of nature necessary to build proteins and DNA. As Paul Davis has written, if it wasn't for carbon, life as we know it would be impossible. Probably any sort of life would be impossible. Yet carbon is not all that plentiful, even in humans, who so vitally depend on it. Of every 200 atoms in your body, 126 are hydrogen, 51 are oxygen, and just 19 are carbon. Of the remaining 4, 3 are nitrogen, and the remaining atom is divided among all the other elements. Other elements are critical not for creating life, but for sustaining it. We need iron to manufacture hemoglobin, and without it we would die. Cobalt is necessary for the creation of vitamin B12. Potassium and a very little sodium are literally good for your nerves. Molybdenum, manganese, and vanadium help to keep your enzymes purring. Zinc, bless it, oxidizes alcohol. We have evolved to utilize or tolerate these things. We could hardly be here otherwise, but even then we live within narrow ranges of acceptance. Selenium is vital to all of us, but take in just a little too much, and it will be the last thing you ever do. The degree to which organisms require or tolerate certain elements is a relic of their evolution. Sheep and cattle now graze side by side, but actually have very different mineral requirements. Modern cattle need quite a lot of copper because they evolved in parts of Europe and Africa where copper was abundant. Sheep, on the other hand, evolved in copper-poor areas of Asia Minor. As a rule, and not surprisingly, our tolerance for elements is directly proportionate to their abundance in the Earth's crust. We have evolved to expect, and in some cases actually need, the tiny amounts of rare elements that accumulate in the flesh or fiber that we eat. But step up the doses, in some cases by only a tiny amount, and we can soon cross a threshold. Much of this is only imperfectly understood. No one knows, for example, whether a tiny amount of arsenic is necessary for our well-being or not. Some authorities say it is, some not. All that is certain is that too much of it will kill you. The properties of the elements can become more curious still when they are combined. Oxygen and hydrogen, for instance, are two of the most combustion-friendly elements around, but put them together and they make incombustible water. Oxygen itself is not combustible, it merely facilitates the combustion of other things. This is just as well, for if oxygen were combustible, each time you lit a match, all the air around you would burst into flame. Hydrogen gas, on the other hand, is extremely combustible, as the dirigible Hindenburg demonstrated on May 6, 1937, in Lakehurst, New Jersey, when its hydrogen fuel burst explosively into flame, killing 36 people. Odder still in combination are sodium, one of the most unstable of all elements, and chlorine, one of the most toxic. Drop a small lump of pure sodium into ordinary water, and it will explode with enough force to kill. Chlorine is even more notoriously hazardous. Though useful in small concentrations for killing microorganisms, it's chlorine you smell in bleach, in larger volumes it is lethal. Chlorine was the element of choice for many of the poison gases of the First World War, and, as many a sore-eyed swimmer will attest, even in exceedingly dilute form the human body doesn't appreciate it. Yet put these two nasty elements together and what do you get? Sodium chloride, common table salt. By and large, if an element doesn't naturally find its way into our systems, if it isn't soluble in water, say, we tend to be intolerant of it. Lead poisons us because we were never exposed to it until we began to fashion it into food vessels and pipes for plumbing. Not incidentally, lead's symbol is PB for the Latin plumbum, the source word for our modern plumbing. The Romans also flavoured their wine with lead, which may be part of the reason they are not the force they used to be. As we have seen elsewhere, our own performance with lead, not to mention mercury, cadmium, and all the other industrial pollutants with which we routinely dose ourselves, does not leave us a great deal of room for smirking. When elements don't occur naturally on Earth, we have evolved no tolerance for them, and so they tend to be extremely toxic to us, as with plutonium. Our tolerance for plutonium is zero. There is no level at which it is not going to make you want to lie down. I have brought you a long way to make a small point. A big part of the reason that Earth seems so miraculously accommodating is that we evolved to suit its conditions. What we marvel at is not that it is suitable to life, but that it is suitable to our life, and hardly surprising, really. It may be that many of the things that make it so splendid to us, well-proportioned sun, doting moon, sociable carbon, more magma than you can shake a stick at, and all the rest, seem splendid simply because they are what we were born to count on. No one can altogether say. Other worlds may harbour beings thankful for their silvery lakes of mercury and drifting clouds of ammonia. They may be delighted that their planet doesn't shake them silly with its grinding plates or spew messy gobs of lava over the landscape, but rather exists in a permanent non-tectonic tranquility. Any visitors to Earth from afar would almost certainly, at the very least, be bemused to find us living in an atmosphere composed of nitrogen, a gas sulkily disinclined to react with anything, and oxygen, which is so partial to combustion that we must place fire stations throughout our cities to protect ourselves from its livelier effects. But even if our visitors were oxygen-breathing bipeds with shopping malls and a fondness for action movies, it is unlikely that they would find Earth ideal. We couldn't even give them lunch, because all our foods contain traces of manganese, selenium, zinc, and other elemental particles, at least some of which would be poisonous to them. To them, Earth might not seem a wondrously congenial place at all. The physicist Richard Feynman used to make a joke about a posteriori conclusions, as they are called. "You know, the most amazing thing happened to me tonight," he would say. "I saw a car with a license plate ARW357. Can you imagine? Of all the millions of license plates in the state, what was the chance that I would see that particular one tonight? Amazing!" His point, of course, was that it was easy to make any banal situation seem extraordinary if you treat it as fateful. So it is possible that the events and conditions that led to the rise of life on Earth are not quite as extraordinary as we like to think. Still, they were extraordinary enough, and one thing is certain, they will have to do until we find some better.
17. Into the Troposphere. Thank goodness for the atmosphere. It keeps us warm. Without it, Earth would be a lifeless ball of ice with an average temperature of minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. In addition, the atmosphere absorbs or deflects incoming swarms of cosmic rays, charged particles, ultraviolet rays, and the like. Altogether, the gaseous padding of the atmosphere is equivalent to a 15-foot thickness of protective concrete. And without it, these invisible visitors from space would slice through us like tiny daggers. Even raindrops would pound us senseless if it weren't for the atmosphere's slowing drag. The most striking thing about our atmosphere is that there isn't very much of it. It extends upwards for about 120 miles, which might seem relatively bounteous when viewed from ground level, but if you shrank the Earth to the size of a standard desktop globe, it would only be about the thickness of a couple of coats of varnish. For scientific convenience, the atmosphere is divided into four unequal layers: troposphere, stratosphere, mesosphere, and ionosphere, now often called the thermosphere. The troposphere is the part that's dear to us. It alone contains enough warmth and oxygen to allow us to function, though even it swiftly becomes uncongenial to life as you climb up through it. From ground level to its highest point, the troposphere, or turning sphere, is about 10 miles thick at the equator and no more than 6 or 7 miles high in the temperate latitudes where most of us live. 80% of the atmosphere's mass, virtually all the water, and thus virtually all the weather, are contained within this thin and wispy layer. There really isn't much between you and oblivion. Beyond the troposphere is the stratosphere. When you see the top of a storm cloud flattening out into the classic anvil shape, you are looking at the boundary between the troposphere and stratosphere. This invisible ceiling is known as the tropopause, and was discovered in 1902 by a Frenchman in a balloon, Léon-Philippe Tesserand de Bord. Pause, in this sense, doesn't mean to stop momentarily, but to cease altogether. It's from the same Greek root as menopause. Even at its greatest extent, the tropopause is not very distant. A fast elevator of the sort used in modern skyscrapers could get you there in about 20 minutes, though you would be well advised not to make the trip. Such a rapid ascent without pressurization would, at the very least, result in severe cerebral and pulmonary edemas, a dangerous excess of fluids in the body's tissues. When the doors opened at the viewing platform, anyone inside would almost certainly be dead or dying. Even a more measured ascent would be accompanied by a great deal of discomfort. The temperature 6 miles up can be -70°F, and you would need, or at least very much appreciate, supplementary oxygen. After you have left the troposphere, the temperature soon warms up again, to about 40°F, thanks to the absorptive effects of ozone, something else de Bort discovered on his daring 1902 ascent. It then plunges to as low as -130°F in the mesosphere, before skyrocketing to 2,700°F or more in the aptly named but very erratic thermosphere, where temperatures can vary by 1,000 degrees from day to night, though it must be said that temperature at such a height becomes a somewhat notional concept. A temperature is really just a measure of the activity of molecules. At sea level, air molecules are so thick that one molecule can move only the tiniest distance, about 0.03 inches to be precise, before banging into another. Because trillions of molecules are constantly colliding, a lot of heat gets exchanged. But at the height of the thermosphere, at 50 miles or more, the air is so thin that any two molecules will be miles apart and hardly ever come in contact. So although each molecule is very warm, there are few interactions between them, and thus little heat transference. This is good news for satellites and spaceships, because if the exchange of heat were more efficient, any man-made object orbiting at that level would burst into flame. Even so, spaceships have to take care in the outer atmosphere, particularly on return trips to Earth, as the Space Shuttle Columbia demonstrated all too tragically in February 2003. Although the atmosphere is very thin, if a craft comes in at too steep an angle, more than about 6 degrees, or too swiftly, it can strike enough molecules to generate drag of an exceedingly combustible nature. Conversely, if an incoming vehicle hit the thermosphere at too shallow an angle, it could well bounce back into space, like a pebble skipped across water. But you needn't venture to the edge of the atmosphere to be reminded of what hopelessly ground-hugging beings we are. As anyone who has spent time in a lofty city will know, you don't have to rise too many thousands of feet from sea level before your body begins to protest. Even experienced mountaineers, with the benefits of fitness, training, and bottled oxygen, quickly become vulnerable at height to confusion, nausea, exhaustion, frostbite, hypothermia, migraine, loss of appetite, and a great many other stumbling dysfunctions. In 100 emphatic ways, the human body reminds its owner that it wasn't designed to operate so far above sea level. Even under the most favourable circumstances, the climber Peter Habler has written of conditions atop Everest, every step at that altitude demands a colossal effort of will. You must force yourself to make every movement, reach for every handhold. You are perpetually threatened by a leaden, deadly fatigue. In The Other Side of Everest, the British mountaineer and filmmaker Matt Dickinson records how Howard Somerville, on a 1924 British expedition up Everest, found himself choking to death after a piece of infected flesh came loose and blocked his windpipe. With a supreme effort, Somerville managed to cough up the obstruction. It turned out to be the entire mucus lining of his larynx. Bodily distress is notorious above 25,000 feet, the area known to climbers as the death zone. But many people become severely debilitated, even dangerously ill, at heights of no more than 15,000 feet or so. Susceptibility has little to do with fitness. Grannies sometimes caper about in lofty situations, while their fitter offspring are reduced to helpless, groaning heaps until conveyed to lower altitudes. The absolute limit of human tolerance for continuous living appears to be about 5,500 metres, or 18,000 feet. But even people conditioned to living at altitude could not tolerate such heights for long. Francis Ashcroft, in Life at the Extremes, notes that there are Andean sulphur mines at 5,800 metres, but that the miners prefer to descend 460 metres each evening and climb back up the following day, rather than live continuously at that elevation. People who habitually live at altitude have often spent thousands of years developing disproportionately large chests and lungs, increasing their density of oxygen-bearing red blood cells by almost a third, though there are limits to how much thickening with red cells the blood supply can stand. Moreover, above 5,500 metres, even the most well-adapted women cannot provide a growing fetus with enough oxygen to bring it to its full term. In the 1780s, when people began to make experimental balloon ascents in Europe, something that surprised them was how chilly it got as they rose. The temperature drops about 3 degrees Fahrenheit with every 1,000 feet you climb. Logic would seem to indicate that the closer you get to a source of heat, the warmer you would feel. Part of the explanation is that you are not really getting nearer the sun in any meaningful sense. The sun is 93 million miles away. To move a couple of 1,000 feet closer to it is like taking one step closer to a bushfire in Australia when you are standing in Ohio and expecting to smell smoke. The answer, again, takes us back to the question of the density of molecules in the atmosphere. Sunlight energizes atoms. It increases the rate at which they jiggle and jounce, and in their enlivened state they crash into one another, releasing heat. When you feel the sun warm on your back on a summer's day, it's really excited atoms you feel. The higher you climb, the fewer molecules there are, and so the fewer collisions between them. Air is deceptive stuff. Even at sea level, we tend to think of the air as being ethereal and all but weightless. In fact, it has plenty of bulk, and that bulk often exerts itself. As a marine scientist named Wyville Thomson wrote more than a century ago, "We sometimes find when we get up in the morning, by a rise of an inch in the barometer, that nearly half a ton has been quietly piled upon us during the night. But we experience no inconvenience, rather a feeling of exhilaration and buoyancy, since it requires a little less exertion to move our bodies in the denser medium." The reason you don't feel crushed under that extra half ton of pressure is the same reason your body would not be crushed deep beneath the sea. It is made mostly of incompressible fluids, which push back, equalizing the pressures within and without. But get air in motion, as with a hurricane or even a stiff breeze, and you will quickly be reminded that it has very considerable mass. Altogether, there are about 5,200 million million tons of air around us, 25 million tons for every square mile of the planet, a not inconsequential volume. When you get millions of tons of atmosphere rushing past at 30 or 40 miles an hour, it's hardly a surprise that limbs snap and roof tiles go flying. As Anthony Smith notes, a typical weather front may consist of 750 million tons of cold air pinned beneath a billion tons of warmer air. Hardly a wonder that the result is at times meteorologically exciting. Certainly, there is no shortage of energy in the world above our heads. One thunderstorm, it has been calculated, can contain an amount of energy equivalent to 4 days' use of electricity for the whole United States. In the right conditions, storm clouds can rise to heights of 6 to 10 miles and contain updrafts and downdrafts of 100 miles an hour. These are often side by side, which is why pilots don't want to fly through them. In all, the internal turmoil particles within the cloud pick up electrical charges. For reasons not entirely understood, the lighter particles tend to become positively charged and to be wafted by air currents to the top of the cloud. The heavier particles linger at the base, accumulating negative charges. These negatively charged particles have a powerful urge to rush to the positively charged Earth, and good luck to anything that gets in their way. A bolt of lightning travels at 270,000 miles an hour and can heat the air around it to a decidedly crisp 50,000 degrees Fahrenheit, several times hotter than the surface of the sun. At any one moment, 1,800 thunderstorms are in progress around the globe, some 40,000 a day. Day and night across the planet, every second, about 100 lightning bolts hit the ground. The sky is a lively place. Much of our knowledge of what goes on up there is surprisingly recent. Jet streams, usually located about 30,000 to 35,000 feet up, can bowl along at up to 180 miles an hour and vastly influence weather systems over whole continents. Yet their existence wasn't suspected until pilots began to fly into them during the Second World War. Even now, a great deal of atmospheric phenomena is barely understood. A form of wave motion, popularly known as clear air turbulence, occasionally enlivens airplane flights. About 20 such incidents a year are serious enough to need reporting. They are not associated with cloud structures or anything else that can be detected visually or by radar. They are just pockets of startling turbulence in the middle of tranquil skies. In a typical incident, a plane en route from Singapore to Sydney was flying over central Australia in calm conditions when it suddenly fell 300 feet, enough to fling unsecured people against the ceiling. 12 people were injured, one seriously. No one knows what causes such disruptive cells of air. The process that moves air around in the atmosphere is the same process that drives the internal engine of the planet, namely convection. Moist, warm air from the equatorial regions rises until it hits the barrier of the tropopause and spreads out. As it travels away from the equator and cools, it sinks. When it hits bottom, some of the sinking air looks for an area of low pressure to fill and heads back for the equator, completing the circuit. At the equator, the convection process is generally stable and the weather predictably fair, but in temperate zones the patterns are far more seasonal, localized, and random, which results in an endless battle between systems of high-pressure air and low. Low-pressure systems are created by rising air, which conveys water molecules into the sky, forming clouds and eventually rain. Warm air can hold more moisture than cool air, which is why tropical and summer storms tend to be the heaviest. Thus, low areas tend to be associated with clouds and rain, and highs generally spell sunshine and fair weather. When two such systems meet, it often becomes manifest in the clouds. For instance, stratus clouds, those unlovable featureless sprawls that give us our overcast skies, happen when moisture-bearing updrafts lack the oomph to break through a level of more stable air above, and instead spread out, like smoke hitting a ceiling. Indeed, if you watch a smoker sometime, you can get a very good idea of how things work by watching how smoke rises from a cigarette in a still room. At first, it goes straight up. This is called a laminar flow, if you need to impress anyone, and then it spreads out in a diffused, wavy layer. The greatest supercomputer in the world, taking measurements in the most carefully controlled environment, cannot tell you what forms these ripplings will take, so you can imagine the difficulties that confront meteorologists when they try to predict such motions in a spinning, windy, large-scale world. What we do know is that because heat from the sun is unevenly distributed, differences in air pressure arise on the planet. Air can't abide this, so it rushes around trying to equalize things everywhere. Wind is simply the air's way of trying to keep things in balance. Air always flows from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure, as you would expect. Think of anything with air under pressure, a balloon or an air tank, and think how insistently that pressured air wants to get someplace else. And the greater the discrepancy in pressures, the faster the wind blows. Incidentally, wind speeds, like most things that accumulate, grow exponentially. So a wind blowing at 200 miles an hour is not simply 10 times stronger than a wind blowing at 20 miles an hour, but 100 times stronger, and hence that much more destructive. Introduce several million tons of air to this accelerator effect, and the result can be exceedingly energetic. A tropical hurricane can release in 24 hours as much energy as a rich, medium-sized nation like Britain or France uses in a year. The impulse of the atmosphere to seek equilibrium was first suspected by Edmund Halley, the man who was everywhere, and elaborated upon in the 18th century by his fellow Briton George Hadley, who saw that rising and falling columns of air tended to produce cells, known ever since as Hadley cells. Though a lawyer by profession, Hadley had a keen interest in the weather. He was, after all, English, and also suggested a link between his cells, the Earth's spin, and the apparent deflections of air that give us our trade winds. However, it was an engineering professor at the École Polytechnique in Paris, Gustave Gaspard de Coriolis, who worked out the details of these interactions in 1835, and thus we call it the Coriolis effect. Coriolis's other distinction at the school was to introduce water coolers, which are still known there as Corios, apparently. The Earth revolves at a brisk 1,041 miles an hour at the equator, though as you move toward the poles, the rate slopes off considerably, to about 600 miles an hour in London or Paris, for instance. The reason for this is self-evident when you think about it. If you're on the equator, the spinning Earth has to carry you quite a distance, about 40,000 kilometres, to get you back to the same spot. If you stand beside the North Pole, however, you may need travel only a few feet to complete a revolution. Yet in both cases, it takes 24 hours to get you back to where you began. Therefore, it follows that the closer you get to the equator, the faster you must be spinning. The Coriolis effect explains why anything moving through the air in a straight line laterally to the Earth's spin will, given enough distance, seem to curve to the right in the northern hemisphere and to the left in the southern as the Earth revolves beneath it. The standard way to envision this is to imagine yourself at the centre of a large carousel and tossing a ball to someone positioned on the edge. By the time the ball gets to the perimeter, the target person has moved on and the ball passes behind him. From his perspective, it looks as if it has curved away from him. That is the Coriolis effect, and it is what gives weather systems their curl and sends hurricanes spinning off like tops. The Coriolis effect is also why naval guns firing artillery shells have to adjust to left or right. A shell fired 15 miles would otherwise deviate by about 100 yards and plop harmlessly into the sea. Considering the practical and psychological importance of the weather to nearly everyone, it's surprising that meteorology didn't really get going as a science until shortly before the turn of the 19th century. Though the term meteorology itself had been around since 1626, when it was coined by a T. Granger in a book of logic. Part of the problem was that successful meteorology requires the precise measurement of temperatures, and thermometers for a long time proved more difficult to make than you might expect. An accurate reading was dependent on getting a very even bore in a glass tube, and that wasn't easy to do. The first person to crack the problem was Daniel Gabriel Fahrenheit, a Dutch maker of instruments who produced an accurate thermometer in 1717. However, for reasons unknown, he calibrated the instrument in a way that put freezing at 32 degrees and boiling at 212 degrees. From the outset, this numeric eccentricity bothered some people, and in 1742, Anders Celsius, a Swedish astronomer, came up with a competing scale. In proof of the proposition that inventors seldom get manners entirely right, Celsius made boiling point 0 and freezing point 100 on his scale. But that was soon reversed. The person most frequently identified as the father of modern meteorology was an English pharmacist named Luke Howard, who came to prominence at the beginning of the 19th century. Howard is chiefly remembered now for giving cloud types their names in 1803. Although he was an active and respected member of the Linnaean Society and employed Linnaean principles in his new scheme, Howard chose the rather more obscure Askesian Society as the forum to announce his new system of classification. The Askesian Society, you may just recall from an earlier chapter, was the body whose members were unusually devoted to the pleasures of nitrous oxide. So we can only hope they treated Howard's presentation with the sober attention it deserved. It is a point on which Howard scholars are curiously silent. Howard divided clouds into three groups: stratus, for the layered clouds; cumulus, for the fluffy ones, the word means heaped in Latin; and cirrus, meaning curled, for the high, thin, feathery formations that generally presage colder weather. To these he subsequently added a fourth term, nimbus, from the Latin for cloud, for a rain cloud. The beauty of Howard's system was that the basic components could be freely recombined to describe every shape and size of passing cloud: stratocumulus, cirrostratus, cumulocongestus, and so on. It was an immediate hit, and not just in England. The poet Johann von Goethe, in Germany, was so taken with the system that he dedicated four poems to Howard. Howard's system has been much added to over the years, so much so that the encyclopedic, if little read, International Cloud Atlas runs to two volumes.
But interestingly, virtually all the post-Howard cloud types, Mammatus, Peleus, Nebulosis, Spissatus, Floccus, and Mediocris, are a sampling, have never caught on with anyone outside meteorology, and not terribly much there, I'm told. Incidentally, the first, much thinner edition of that atlas, produced in 1896, divided clouds into 10 basic types, of which the plumpest and most cushiony-looking was number 9, cumulonimbus. That seems to have been the source of the expression, to be on cloud 9. If you've ever been struck by how beautifully crisp and well-defined the edges of cumulus clouds tend to be, while other clouds are more blurry, the explanation is that in cumulus cloud there is a pronounced boundary between the moist interior of the cloud and the dry area beyond it. Any water molecule that strays beyond the edge of the cloud is immediately zapped by the dry air beyond, allowing the cloud to keep its fine edge. Much higher cirrus clouds are composed of ice, and the zone between the edge of the cloud and the air beyond is not so clearly delineated, which is why they tend to be blurry at the edges. For all the heft and fury of the occasional anvil-headed storm cloud, the average cloud is actually a benign and surprisingly insubstantial thing. A fluffy summer cumulus, several hundred yards to a side, may contain no more than 25 or 30 gallons of water. About enough to fill a bathtub, as James Treffel has noted. You can get some sense of the immaterial quality of clouds by strolling through fog, which is, after all, nothing more than a cloud that lacks the will to fly. To quote Treffel again, if you walk 100 yards through a typical fog, you will come into contact with only about half a cubic inch of water, not enough to give you a decent drink. In consequence, clouds are not great reservoirs of water. Only about 0.035% of the Earth's fresh water is floating around above us at any moment. Depending on where it falls, the prognosis for a water molecule varies widely. If it lands in fertile soil, it will be soaked up by plants or re-evaporated directly within hours or days. If it finds its way down to the groundwater, however, it may not see sunlight again for many years, thousands if it gets really deep. When you look at a lake, you are looking at a collection of molecules that have been there on average for about a decade. In the ocean, the residence time is thought to be more like 100 years. Altogether, about 60% of water molecules in a rainfall are returned to the atmosphere within a day or two. Once evaporated, they spend no more than a week or so, Drury says 12 days, in the sky, before falling again as rain. Evaporation is a swift process, as you can easily gauge by the fate of a puddle on a summer's day. Even something as large as the Mediterranean would dry out in 1,000 years if it were not continually replenished. Such an event occurred a little under 6 million years ago and provoked what is known to science as the Messinian salinity crisis. What happened was that continental movement closed the Strait of Gibraltar. As the Mediterranean dried, its evaporated contents fell as freshwater rain into other seas, mildly diluting their saltiness, indeed making them just dilute enough to freeze over larger areas than normal. The enlarged area of ice bounced back more of the sun's heat and pushed Earth into an ice age. So at least the theory goes. What is certainly true, as far as we can tell, is that a little change in the Earth's dynamics can have repercussions beyond our imagining. Such an event, as we shall see a little further on, may even have created us. Oceans are the real powerhouse of the planet's surface behavior. Indeed, meteorologists increasingly treat oceans and atmosphere as a single system, which is why we must give them a little of our attention here. Water is marvelous at holding and transporting heat. Every day the Gulf Stream carries an amount of heat to Europe equivalent to the world's output of coal for 10 years, which is why Britain and Ireland have such mild winters compared with Canada and Russia. But water also warms slowly, which is why lakes and swimming pools are cold even on the hottest days. For that reason, there tends to be a lag in the official astronomical start of a season and the actual feeling that the season has started. So spring may officially start in the Northern Hemisphere in March, but it doesn't feel like it in most places until April at the very earliest. The oceans are not one uniform mass of water. Their differences in temperature, salinity, depth, density, and so on have huge effects on how they move heat around, which in turn affects climate.
The Atlantic, for instance, is saltier than the Pacific, and a good thing, too. The saltier water is, the denser it is, and dense water sinks. Without its extra burden of salt, the Atlantic currents would proceed up to the Arctic, warming the North Pole, but depriving Europe of all that kindly warmth. The main agent of heat transfer on Earth is what is known as thermohaline circulation, which originates in slow, deep currents far below the surface, a process first detected by the scientist-adventurer Count von Rumford in 1797. What happens is that surface waters, as they get to the vicinity of Europe, grow dense and sink to great depths, and begin a slow trip back to the southern hemisphere. When they reach Antarctica, they're caught up in the Antarctic circumpolar current, where they are driven onward into the Pacific. The process is very slow. It can take 1,500 years for water to travel from the North Atlantic to the mid-Pacific, but the volumes of heat and water they move are very considerable, and the influence on the climate is enormous. As for the question of how anyone could possibly figure out how long it takes a drop of water to get from one ocean to another, the answer is that scientists can measure compounds in the water, like chlorofluorocarbons, and work out how long it has been since they were last in the air. By comparing a lot of measurements from different depths and locations, they can reasonably chart the water's movement. Thermohaline circulation not only moves heat around, but also helps to stir up nutrients as the currents rise and fall, making greater volumes of the ocean habitable for fish and other marine creatures. Unfortunately, it appears the circulation may also be very sensitive to change. According to computer simulations, even a modest dilution of the ocean's salt content, from increased melting of the Greenland ice sheet, for instance, could disrupt the cycle disastrously. The seas do one other great favour for us. They soak up tremendous volumes of carbon and provide a means for it to be safely locked away. One of the oddities of our solar system is that the sun burns about 25% more brightly now than when the solar system was young. This should have resulted in a much warmer Earth. Indeed, as the English geologist Aubrey Manning has put it, this colossal change should have had an absolutely catastrophic effect on the Earth, and yet it appears that our world has hardly been affected. So what keeps the world stable and cool? Life does. Trillions upon trillions of tiny marine organisms that most of us have never heard of, foraminiferans and coccoliths and calcareous algae, capture atmospheric carbon in the form of carbon dioxide when it falls as rain and use it, in combination with other things, to make their tiny shells. By locking the carbon up in their shells, they keep it from being re-evaporated into the atmosphere, where it would build up dangerously as a greenhouse gas. Eventually, all the tiny foraminiferans and coccoliths and so on die and fall to the bottom of the sea, where they are compressed into limestone. It is remarkable, when you behold an extraordinary natural feature like the White Cliffs of Dover in England, to reflect that it is made up of nothing but tiny, deceased marine organisms. But even more remarkable, when you realize how much carbon they cumulatively sequester. A 6-inch cube of Dover chalk will contain well over 1,000 litres of compressed carbon dioxide that would otherwise be doing us no good at all. Altogether, there is about 20,000 times as much carbon locked away in the Earth's rocks as in the atmosphere. Eventually, much of that limestone will end up feeding volcanoes, and the carbon will return to the atmosphere and fall to the Earth in rain, which is why the whole is called the long-term carbon cycle. The process takes a very long time, about 500,000 years for a typical carbon atom, but in the absence of any other disturbance, it works remarkably well at keeping the climate stable. Unfortunately, human beings have a careless predilection for disrupting this cycle by putting lots of extra carbon into the atmosphere, whether the foraminiferans are ready for it or not. Since 1850, it has been estimated, we have lofted about 100 billion tons of extra carbon into the air, a total that increases by about 7 billion tons each year. Overall, that's not actually all that much. Nature, mostly through the belchings of volcanoes and the decay of plants, sends about 200 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere each year, nearly 30 times as much as we do with our cars and factories. But you have only to look at the haze that hangs over our cities to see what a difference our contribution makes. We know from samples of very old ice that the natural level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that is, before we started inflating it with industrial activity, is about 280 parts per million. By 1958, when people in lab coats started to pay attention to it, it had risen to 315 parts per million. Today, it is over 360 parts per million, and rising by roughly 0.25% a year. By the end of the 21st century, it is forecast to rise to about 560.